Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Does money really grow on trees? In this hour, the economics of conservation, or butterflies, aren't free. First, we turn our attention to the Middle East, where Secretary of State Colin Powell has ended a 10-day mission. Earlier, I spoke to Matt Rees, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Time magazine, and asked about how the Powell visit was being scored in the region.
His score is pretty low, but they were reckoning on that even before he arrived. American officials here in the embassy and the consulate were saying that the possibility of failure was quite real. Now, for them to be saying that even before he arrived tells you a little something about what they were expecting. Now, at his press conference today, Powell was as close to being angry as a diplomat like him ever gets. So it's looking pretty bad from the American perspective. However, he has said there are compromises that are needed. I've given it to them straight, both the Israelis and the Palestinians, and now I'm leaving it to guys at a lower level than me to push that ahead, and I'll come back before too long to see where we've gotten.
What were the compromises he asked of each side?
The main thing for the Israelis is that he used perhaps the strongest language yet from an American Secretary of State against the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now, in the past, those have been referred to by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright as obstacles to peace. But that's a fairly neutral phrase. Today he called them a destructive influence. So it's fairly clear that he expressed considerable frustration, not to say even anger, from the American side to Ariel Sharon when he met him on that. One of the things that at Time magazine we've uncovered is that one of the proposals he was trying to get the Israelis to sign on to was to uproot the settlements in the Gaza Strip, which are mostly isolated and tend not to be thought of as having a biblical significance in the way that the ones in the West Bank do. But the Israelis don't like that idea. On the Palestinian side, he wants much, much stronger work from Arafat and his people against the suicide bombers, but also against the people who conduct shooting attacks on the roads in the West Bank against soldiers and settlers. What he's getting at there is that those attacks also put Israel's political back against the wall domestically.
But that's a significant request of Arafat. That would be a real compromise because that's the quote, resistance, isn't it?
That is the resistance, but then again, it all depends on whether you are still of the mind that Arafat has signed a peace agreement, and this is what he did agree to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, a year and a half ago, Arafat decided to move to a different phase, but it's not clear that he decided to put the peace process entirely behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And from my understanding is that a year and a half ago or thereabouts, when the Intifada began, it was viewed by the Palestinians as a different phase of the peace process, if you like, the battle for the final status talks.
Mm-hmm.
But when the fighting ended, they would be in a better position to sit down with the Israelis and say, okay, we're going to have the final status talks. This is what we want on Jerusalem, refugees, borders, etc.
Do people with Powell answer the question of, well, does he have now the capability, even assuming he had the will, does he have the capability to stop the violence? Has the Palestinian Authority been so degraded that it can't really exert authority?
He can't exert authority in the next 5 minutes, but if, as they promised, the Israelis do pull out, it will give Arafat an opportunity to reassert his authority. Because after all, the guys that have been arrested, and there have been at least 1,200 of them arrested, are not the green-uniformed national security forces that he has. They are mostly people from this militia, the Tanzim, many of whom are in one of his intelligence services. But in terms of the pure military muscle, if you like, he's still got that, and that's still there, and still will be operational. They might not have barracks to sleep in because the Israelis have blown them up, but they do still have their guns, and they do still have a command structure that's there.
Of his two meetings, that with Sharon, or series of meetings, and those with Arafat, with which figure did he have the more difficult time?
It's hard to pick one, to tell you the truth. They were neither of them particularly happy meetings. Particularly out in Ramallah, there were a lot of protesters around, some foreigners and even some left-wing Israelis. With Sharon, Powell tends to see himself as having a certain kind of kinship from their military background. And I think he appreciates the straightforwardness of Sharon. It's certainly perhaps a little easier to deal with him than with Arafat at the moment, because Arafat is under greater pressure. He's in a strange situation, sure, to say the least.
Dory Gold, an advisor to Sharon, told CNN, he was asked, what does Powell have to show for this? What has he accomplished? And he drew attention to the Lebanon front, and he said that Powell's mission to Damascus and discussions with the about quieting the Hezbollah shelling into Israel, that this was a significant intervention and that it had already been having some effect. What are you hearing about that?
Powell has certainly given the Arab world something to hang on to here. He wanted very much to take the Saudi peace proposal, which at the recent Arab League meeting was more or less given a green light, and lay it on the table before the Israelis. And he got a reasonably good response. It wasn't rejected, and Sharon has said that they would look favorably on this regional conference. They might even let Arafat out of his office to go to it, which would be probably in June. And that's something which, when he went up to Lebanon and to Syria, Powell was able to use against the Lebanese and the Syrians to make them calm down the situation there, to say, don't blow this chance.
Matt Rees is Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. In the past, when big business and tree huggers collided, nature usually lost. But a new conversation has started between these antagonists. In her book, The New Economy of Nature, The Quest to Make Conservation Profitable, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Ellison argues that corporations and conservationists increasingly find common ground on the financial value of protecting environmental assets. What do you make of this curious courtship between green and gold? What price tag would you put on clean water, and would you be willing to pay for it? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With me now from Washington is Catherine Ellison, and in the studio is Andrew Hoffman, professor of management at Boston University. He has written extensively on corporate responses to the environmental movement and is the author of From Heresy to Dogma, An Institutional History of Corporate Environmentalism, which has won the Rachel Carson Prize for 2001, given by the Society for Social Studies of Science. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
Catherine, let's start with you. Describe for us this new concept, the new economy of nature.
Well, sure. You ask if money grows on trees. The fact is that it does, and it has for a long time. We've all profited forever from the many services that nature offers. The way that forests capture carbon dioxide and help stabilize the climate, and the way that wetlands help cleanse our water. The problem is they've never been taken into account by our economic system. So we've thought of conservation as a philanthropy, and that just hasn't worked.
Personal virtue, that's what Dick Cheney called it.
Mm-hmm. Well, our book, The New Economy of Nature, describes cases from all over the world where this attitude is just changing very dramatically, and people are making or saving money by valuing the environment One of the best cases is in New York, where the city of New York was ordered by the Environmental Protection Agency to build a big filtration plant that would have cost as much as $8 billion. And instead, they came up with a plan to protect their watershed and actually buy up land, strategically important land around the reservoirs, and pay farmers to modernize their farms and make them cleaner. And so far, this program is really working, and they've spent considerably less, around $2 billion at the most.
You mentioned the notion of trying to find a price for our use of the environment and in a way to sort of make us price sensitive about that. Explain for us how that happens.
Well, I think a lot of people are already familiar with the idea of the environmental harm, the harm that we do to the environment, as being a negative externality. And in some ways, there have been ways for many years in which people are paying the price for environmental harm. There's pollution permits. But what's the challenge is really to find ways to integrate the services that nature gives us into the economy.
And give us some examples of these services that we get from nature that have economic valence to them.
Well, for instance, like I mentioned, the way wetlands help filter water, and that's a case in New York. Mm-hmm. Or in Napa, a case that we write about that's very interesting concerns the way that the town of Napa, which for many years was getting hit by these terrible floods, had to have a flood protection program. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers came in and said, we're going to build one of our traditional plans with high levees. But the city rejected the plan because they said there were a number of activists there who said it was a river-killing plan. They came up with their own plan that was actually more expensive than the Corps of Engineers plan. But what it did was, instead of having these levees that blocked the views of the river and cut the river off, it let the river be a river. They restored wetlands. They ended up with some beautiful river views. They used the floodplain for a kind of a natural flood protection, meaning that they moved people off the floodplain and they let it do its work that it had done historically of absorbing the water. And what they ended up with is beautiful views for the downtown area, which is now undergoing a historic revival. All sorts of businesses have moved in and there's a great new museum. So the town is actually getting quite a few very important benefits that it wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Now, these are both examples you gave, the New York one and this, of essentially government actions, where issues of the bottom line are not so urgent. But you also mentioned that those are coming to the fore, too. Particularly, you mentioned a fund that John Hancock is talking about establishing, which would essentially, well, you tell us.
Okay. There's all sorts of permutations of this, and a lot of businesses, this is pretty fascinating, because without any kind of government regulation, businesses are jumping into the trading of what's called carbon credits. Now, carbon credits in the United States don't legally exist. Nonetheless, businesses are paying already millions of dollars. Yep. There's big energy companies that have bought supposedly carbon credits from forests in Brazil.
A carbon credit is what?
Okay, what it means, it's a pollution permit.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you figure out the capacity of a forest, for instance, to absorb a ton of greenhouse gases, and that would be a carbon credit. Or you could, in another mm-hmm. case, you could buy solar panels in Sri Lanka to replace kerosene lamps, and you could get carbon credits supposedly through that.
So if you invested in this, if you were a corporation that invested in this fund to preserve forest in Brazil, you could pollute more in the United States. Is that a crude version of the?
Well, that's crude. The motivation would be a lot of these companies are worried that ultimately, I don't know how it's been in Boston, but today in New York and Washington, it was in the high 90s. People are getting more and more conscious that climate change is a serious problem. And they're expecting that one day the government's going to step in and do something about it, perhaps one day soon. So they're worried that there could be limits suddenly on the number of CO2 emissions that they can spew. And they're trying to find ways to hedge. If there were a cap on their emissions, how can they mitigate what they're doing?
We're talking this hour about putting a price tag on the ecosystem. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about nature as the ultimate service economy this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Catherine Ellison, the co-author of The New Economy of Nature, and with Andrew Hoffman, professor at BU School of Management and author of From Heresy to Dogma, An Institutional History of Corporate Environmentalism. Andrew Hoffman, take us into corporate environmentalism. How did this start, and how far has it got, and where is it heading?
Mm-hmm. Well, it started in the 1960s. The environmental movement really started to emerge then. It grew through the 70s, 80s, 90s until today. It's not a new phenomenon. It's an evolving one. Began with growing public concern, which precipitated government regulation. Social activists became very influential in the 80s. And in the 90s, significant economic interests to the corporate enterprise started to press for environmental pressures or environmental concerns, insurance companies, banks, investors, as Catherine said. And they're not just looking at social responsibility. A lot of the early green investment funds really tried to steer clear of oil, chemicals, polluting industries. Mm-hmm. But they've become more sophisticated since then to say that that's not the wisest strategy. What they look for instead is best in class. They'll look for the best oil company, the best chemical company, thinking that good environmental management means good management overall, and therefore they can get a few basis points on their investment and pick the winners within a particular industry.
And give us some success stories here, companies that have actually made money by going green.
Okay, well, there are simple examples in many different forms. Take the Tennessee Valley Authority, a large power company. If you look at a power plant, what you're usually looking at is the scrubbers. That's the biggest piece of equipment there, and that's removing contaminants from the airstream. Yeah, that comes out in terms of fly ash, which is heavy in materials that can be used in sheetrock, in wallboard. Mm-hmm. And so they used to throw that in the landfill. Now they can actually sell it. They'll actually optimize the operating conditions of the power plant to improve the yield of their fly ash because they can sell that for a considerable profit. Mm-hmm. It requires looking at things a little bit differently, looking at opportunities rather than threats, seeing the economic value in things that were previously taken for granted as economic costs.
Now, this is different, really, in vital respects from corporate social responsibility, which often really comes under the heading of PR.
Right.
But this is different. This is self-interest.
Well, social responsibility can clearly be beyond PR.
Sure.
But this is the market system responding to the idea that nature has value. And it happens slowly. Insurance companies started to wake up to it when the Bhopal disaster happened in India, and they were looking at some significant costs to bail Union Carbide out of that. And they started to reassess what their coverage of pollution liability was. When insurance companies care about your environmental practices, that really gets companies to listen.
So companies are, in many respects, ahead of government regulation.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Government is always there in the background.
Okay.
They're that stick waiting to hit. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of progressive actions by companies are really preemptive actions to stop government regulation from happening. If you look in the forests of New England, a lot of forestry companies now are working in alliance with groups like the Appalachian Mountain Club. They're doing this because they want to keep state governments from having referendum to ban clear-cutting or other practices that they want to keep going. So it's preemptive. The government always has to be there as that stick waiting in the closet.
But Catherine Ellison was saying a moment ago that they're sort of preparing against the global warming regulation. Mm-hmm. They're ahead of it in that respect,
yep.
Many companies.
But it's the idea that regulation may be coming.
It may be coming, indeed.
Yes.
Indeed. Catherine, you mentioned a moment ago carbon trading. And, of course, one feature of the Enron business was Enron had hoped to get into that in a big way. Now, that tells me that there's room for speculation in this field if Enron was going to get into it.
Well, that's obviously where government can play a strong role. I mean, it's not just the launcher of these markets, but there has to be a strong role in regulating. One thing that we want to be really clear about, Gretchen Daly, my co-author, and I in our book, is that it's not at all a free market treatise. We strongly believe in the role of governments in regulating as well as starting these markets. But I wanted to tell you about another story, if
Please.
I could.
That's, sure.
It's I find it really fascinating on the line of carbon credits. Certification of products has been an interesting permutation of this value of making conservation profitable. It's also been a reaction to strong pressure by environmental groups. For instance, you've probably heard of the Forest Stewardship Council that certifies wood as sustainably harvested. But another way of certifying products is there's a growing movement in the United States and in Europe to certify products as climate neutral. Climate neutral, meaning that a company will measure its greenhouse gas emissions and reduce them. The idea is to be honorable, you first reduce those emissions as much as you can through efficiency measures. But then you find ways to offset those emissions by some of the ways that I was talking about before, you know, for instance, investing in public schools to refit their boilers and things like that. And you can offset, supposedly make yourself climate neutral with no effect on the climate. There's a number of companies doing this. There's more than 100 companies that are doing this in England, and I recently talked to one of the guys who certifies them, and he said that you can even have your bar mitzvah bar mitzvahs and weddings have been climate neutral. And in the States, we're seeing a lot of companies like Shackley Products. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're a very environmentally conscious company. Mm-hmm. And but I recently talked to an executive at a multi-billion-dollar paper company who's very interested in coming out with a line of paper that he can brand as climate cool. And he said that global warming, he said, no one pun intended, is the hottest issue of the day. You know, recycling is passé, but this is something that consumers will respond to because everybody's sensitive to the change in climate these days.
Sure. But working out these metrics of what's climate neutral and what's not, of measuring these things, this is a huge intellectual challenge, isn't it? And you mentioned a project called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. Can you tell us what that is and what its importance is?
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating thing, development in the last few years. It's an effort by scientists all over the world. It's much like the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but it's meant to be even more comprehensive, and many of the same people are involved. What they are trying to do is map the environmental services all over the world, and it would be the first assessment, basically, of the state of the environment and where the environmental services are and their value as well.
Services rendered by the environment.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And this involves economics, science.
Right. It's going to take many different kinds of discipline. And mostly it's research that's already been done that they're simply trying to gather together. But it's the scientists. I went to a meeting in Veldhoven, the Netherlands, about a year ago, and the scientists were very passionate about giving policymakers a tool. Because still much scientific information is needed. Just like you say, you know, if you're trying to figure out carbon emissions from forests, that's a very difficult thing. I mean, if you want to make an improvement in technology, that's not that complicated scientifically. But if you're really trying to look at the services provided by nature, it's quite complicated and there's a lot still to be known.
Hmm. Listeners, can we make environmentalism profitable? Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Andrew Hoffman, you're holding a new book that you've written called Competitive Environmental Strategy, A Guide to the Changing Business Landscape. Are you arguing here that now this is being used as a competitive tool,
yes,
one business against another?
Yes.
Tell us how that's working.
Companies are trying to find ways to improve the bottom line and improve the top line through environmental issues. Consumers are one way to do it. That's a tough one.
Consumers? I don't understand. You mean by labeling?
Or offering an environmental product. The general wisdom is that when it comes to a product, all attributes have to be the same, price, quality, service. Then environment will kick them over. But while in surveys people say they will pay for an environmentally sensitive product, in practice they're a little more reticent to do it. But companies can improve the bottom line by improving their risk, their insurance premiums, by protecting the environment, lowering their cost of capital, improving operational efficiency. These are where the rubber hits the road. This is where some really interesting stuff is happening on companies trying to eliminate pollution. It can lower their cost of compliance. It can remove the threat of activist protests, all these kinds of things. That's where companies are focusing on how to really make money on environmental issues.
And what about the sort of social responsibility part of it? I mean, BP Shell Oil, for example, if I were to make it conscious, if I could shop at a particular gasoline, if I made that conscious, I might decide, knowing its sort of revolutionary environmental attitudes, at least. I don't know about practices. I'd shop there. Is there
In point of fact, after the Exxon Valdez, Exxon did not notice a considerable drop in their sales.
It did not.
When it comes to gas, people are generally focusing on price and convenience. Some people do, but the vast majority of people don't. But, you know, there are green consumers out there. Mm-hmm. Patagonia is really taking advantage of them in a big way. Don't get me wrong. Organic foods are a huge product. But are they green or are they, a different kind of service sector, a different kind of product sector?
In other words, you've got to be hard-headed about these, or at least corporate people are.
Yeah. Well, you know, Honda is trying to sell their cars as low emission. You can look like Mr. Clean if you drive a Honda. The Prius is out there, so is the Honda hybrid. And they're trying to market to a specific segment, but what's really going to sell those cars is gas mileage.
Gas mileage, sure. Dana is on the line. Hello, welcome.
Oh, welcome. Good evening. I would like to make a point that I've been listening to this program. I agree that federal regulation protecting the environment must never be displaced by corporate social responsibility or a nice-sounding rhetoric, because once the tide turns, there is no law protecting the environment, especially under this administration. No, we should always, I mean, federal law should always have priority. And even if companies are taking steps to sort of preempt a coming law, like, you know, regulating greenhouse gases, even if every corporation in America or in the world decides to become enlightened and work with environmental groups, that law should still be on the books.
So you don't put much truck in President Bush's voluntary global
rhetoric.
Emissions
that's,
plan.
It's very deceptive
greenhouse
rhetoric.
Emissions
Look at his record. It's very deceptive rhetoric. I don't trust that at all. If they, you know, if they really are enlightened corporations as far as the environment goes, then they should comply with emission laws. They should comply with, you know, whatever environmental laws, cutting laws. You know? I mean, I don't want to be more benevolent rapers of the planet. I want to see that stopped, period.
Okay. Andrew?
I don't think anyone's saying it's a choice between regulation or the market. It's not a choice of one or the other. The government is part of the market. It always has been and always will be, not just on the environment, but on trade, on all kinds of issues. But what is going on here is what kind of government involvement is necessary for what kinds of issues. There are command and control type regulations. There are criminal penalties. There are voluntary programs. There are market incentives, as Catherine mentioned. The regulators have a wide toolkit of ways to push the market this way and that, tax incentives, things like that. It comes down to what kind of intervention is appropriate, when can the market system be nudged along, when must be pushed along, when must be mandated along. These are the questions to ask.
What about government in the market as purchaser? Is government making green a criterion in purchasing?
Well, it has in the past. With recycled paper, the Clinton administration tried to boost demand by requiring government to buy recycled paper. It definitely has a role to play in that aspect. That's one of its tools in its toolkit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Catherine Ellison?
But I think Boston, I've heard, is overhauling its bus fleet to be hybrid, mm-hmm. as I
yes.
understand it. So decisions like that can make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. But this all means making the market system work and trying to send signals through the market system. I mean, that is to say, to internalize green within corporations. Of course, you know, Europeans would look at this debate and say, well, wait a minute. All you have to do is tax carbon use. And if you tax it, people will use less of it. That is a kind of non-starter here, Catherine, isn't it?
Yeah, in the past, I mean, it just hasn't been, there hasn't been enough support for those measures in the past. You're right.
And would those sorts of measures be more effectual in the aggregate than the kinds of things we're talking about here with companies going green when it's going to help them?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I think in the United States, and maybe in Europe to a lesser extent, companies have been very sensitive to this different kind of pressure, which is pressure from environmental groups. You see Home Depot, for instance, made the decision to stop buying wood from endangered forests, old-growth forests, because of a big boycott, and that was a very significant decision.
Mm-hmm. Boycotts, Andrew, huh?
That's one form of pressure out there. The Rainforest Action Coalition is working on staples right now to get them to buy or sell more recycled paper. But again, I think that if you want permanent, sustainable change within corporate activity, you don't appeal to social responsibility, mm-hmm. and even government regulation can often be a temporary fix. I'd much rather see a company saying that my insurance company wants me to cut back on pollution, mm-hmm. I'm going to do it. And that's sustainable because the next downturn, they're still going to do it, where social responsibility will go out the window.
And, of course, just by instituting conservation measures within their energy-saving measures within their offices and plants, mm-hmm. companies save huge amounts. I mean, Japan has sort of transformed its energy use through mm-hmm. Partly through the way businesses, offices are run, mm-hmm. factories are run, mm-hmm. and so on. Has that, because they've had to spend a lot more for energy than we do,
right.
isn't that one of the ways in which government could actually hasten this along?
I think the cheap price of gasoline is in the American Constitution. You'll mm-hmm. never get the American public to swallow huge taxes on gasoline. But that would be the best way to get people out of SUVs, is raise the price of gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, how do we get out of the SUVs? That's a big business.
That's a big question.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to see it. I have a friend at the school where I take my young son who gets so infuriated when she sees this row of SUVs. And she says these mothers think they're protecting their children, whereas they're actually doing just the opposite.
Yeah, of course, because they think they're protecting their children because of the weight of these tanks.
Right.
In a plausible accident, but they're hurting their children, and that they're fouling their children's environment and their grandchildren's environment. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it just comes down to education. I mean, there's the studies that show that asthma, there's a pretty strong link between just the asthma rates and climate change already. And, I think that there's probably going to be more serious health problems in our children's lifetimes.
Hmm. Are socially responsible business practices viable or even attractive in our market economy? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to wring profit and not merely display virtue out of the environment. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us is Catherine Ellison. She's the co-author of The New Economy of Nature, The Quest to Make Conservation Profitable, and Andrew Hoffman, professor at BU School of Management and author of From Heresy to Dogma, An Institutional History of Corporate Environmentalism. Andrew Hoffman, President Bush says he wants to protect American business by pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol. Is he right?
No, he's not. To begin, I want to get away from this idea of social responsible business. That's not what we're talking about here. That may have been what it was 10, 15, mm-hmm. 20 years ago, but today a lot of those very same issues are about business strategy. And so, for instance, in Catherine's book, she talks about American Electric Power buying forests in Central America to offset their carbon emissions from their power plant. This isn't social responsibility. This is business strategy. What's the business environment going to be like tomorrow? The rest of the participating nations went ahead and negotiated a treaty. That treaty is being discussed now and may get signed without U.S. participation, without U.S. involvement. This does not represent American industry interests. The final form of this treaty was negotiated last year. What industry wants most is certainty in the business environment and, if possible, control. And a lot of the companies, we live in a globalized world now, a lot of American companies are going to work in countries, have plants in countries that are going to be subject to these new rules by Kyoto. And Bush has pulled out, and they have no voice in what that treaty is going to be. So what are a lot of these companies doing? They're trying to, as she says, hedge their bet, be prepared, what the future business environment might be like in a Kyoto-ratified world, and if possible, try and influence that process. BP, Amoco, Shell, they're betting that Kyoto is going to be part of the business environment. ExxonMobil on the other side, they're betting it's not. It all comes down to a bet on or a contest of who's going to be right. In the end. And it is about business strategy. Carbon is a significant cost factor for energy companies, for oil companies, for paper companies. And it will seriously affect the bottom line.
Hmm.
Just to add that
yes, Catherine.
There's a company called Innova Strategic Value Advisors, and their analysts were one of the most interesting interviews that I did for this book. They were actually measuring carbon exposure among mm-hmm, their clients. Mm-hmm. And they warned that some companies' profits might fall by as much as 30% if a tax on carbon were levied or if there were any kind of limit to carbon emissions, that being the leading greenhouse gas.
And smart investors will watch this.
Mm. Let's take a call. Stephen is on the line. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're fine, I think.
Great show. Three quick points. First, I definitely agree. You need to have the market drive this. While you need to have government involved with it, I wouldn't rely on the government, just as you can see the change from this administration to the last administration. One of the areas that I think the market can drive it a lot is in the green energy, that if businesses, churches, if everyone in their business went out and said when they shop for electricity, which everyone can do now, mm-hmm. that they want to have green energy, that would push up demand, and that would encourage more developers to build these plants. And while they're small compared to a natural gas or a coal power plant, the technology is getting more efficient, the cost is coming down, and that would create demand. And while the green energy area is growing, that's a clearly kind of a win-win opportunity, both from an environmental and from an economic perspective.
Are you suggesting that government and nonprofit institutions should take the first step here?
No, I'm suggesting that everyone. I mean,
even businesses.
Yeah, businesses. I mean, Toyota, for example, mm-hmm. they spent $1 million extra on buying green power. Mm-hmm. They've estimated they got $5 million in.
Oh, I see. They get it back. Yeah.
Yeah. Either from a societal benefit, mm-hmm. From public relations, from mm-hmm. good customer relations.
Yep.
Every employee wants to feel that their company is doing stuff. And like anything else in technology, the more that you grow it, you'll bring price down. Wind has come down by 90% the cost of production in the last two decades.
Mm.
In some places, it's competitive with natural gas. Mm. So that the more you have demand, that will bring down the cost so that our children won't have to make some of these choices.
And that's the market working.
Exactly.
Yeah. You had another point you wanted to make.
Well, no, I guess, and the other point is I've spent the last 20 years helping sustainable business. So I worked with dozens of companies, some of the ones that you guys have mentioned, and that I've seen lots of creative niches. I mean, the air emission credits is one that's still a small area, environmental products. And I think that your guests were talking about how much people would pay. I think the more consumers understand the negative environmental impact and that they can do something, so that just as they're willing to pay more, a niche of consumers is willing to pay more for organic food because mm-hmm. they understand some of the awful things that go into it. I think the same with other products as well.
Well, thanks for the benefit of your experience, Andrew Hoffman. Is this
Yeah, I think green energy is a perfect example of where varying levels of government and market involvement make sense. What's the next generation of vehicles going to be? President Bush just dismantled the Partnership for New Generation Vehicles. It was supposed to get us down to an internal combustion engine that was going to get us 80 miles to the gallon, and it just wasn't working. It was smart to eliminate it. But unfortunately, by eliminating it, there's really no incentive for companies to optimize the performance of their automobiles. CAFE standards are stuck.
Those are the standards that regulate how much emissions the whole fleet of the cars
exactly.
can have.
Yeah. But what he did do is start a new program where he's going to fund alternative energy sources, particularly fuel cells. And that is an area where the government should be involved because a lot of basic research is necessary. So the Department of Energy should be funding research at universities and laboratories around the country on this basic research that companies can then take and perfect into commercialization. They already know how to make how to commercialize the internal combustion engine, leave that to the market, get the CAFE standards up. Fuel cells needs basic research, have the government to do that, and then hand it off to business when it's ready for commercialization.
How about that, Catherine Ellison, ready for commercialization?
Well, I wanted to ask Annie, I'm not a specialist on this, but as I understand it, the government is still giving billions of dollars in subsidies to fossil fuels.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a completely separate area. I was talking about
We're not quite in a free market situation.
Right.
I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could transfer some of those subsidies to renewable fuels?
Mm-hmm. But again, that would raise the price of gasoline, which would cause a public outcry.
Have there, in fact, been studies on public resistance to gas taxes? I mean, or is this just folk wisdom?
I can't pull any off the top of my head, but I'm sure they're there.
I mean, even if pitched in the right way, the green way.
Yeah.
Catherine, do you know anything about this?
Well, you could argue that people who drive SUVs aren't that sensitive to price because they're obviously paying so much more for gas, with their guzzlers.
That's interesting.
But it's all a matter of proportion to the cost of the automobile. Gasoline is still a fairly small part of the entire cost of an automobile.
But this idea of getting technologies ready for market, there's a role for government as incubator, fundamental research. This is how the computer revolution.
That's how the nuclear power industry got started. Government capped the liability. They did a lot of the basic research, and then they turned it over to power companies and said, go for it, and we will cap your liability if there's some kind of an accident.
And I'm glad we say something good about the Bush administration, that they're actually funding, or they want to fund, fuel cell technology.
Yeah, except they left any incentive to increase the average fuel efficiency out there.
Thank you both. Catherine Ellison, co-author of The New Economy of Nature, The Quest to Make Conservation Profitable, and Andrew Hoffman, professor at BU School of Management and author of From Heresy to Dogma, An Institutional History of Corporate Environmentalism. You can read the first chapter of Catherine Ellison's book on our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, remembering the Armenian genocide. This is On Point. In Washington, a group of Armenian Americans held a symbolic march on Capitol Hill. Each year, they join with supportive members of Congress in a rally to ask the U.S. government to officially recognize and commemorate the killing of 1.5 million Armenians in a campaign by the Turkish government from 1915 to 1923. Darren Manoogian is a second-generation Armenian American who works with us here at WBUR. In this diary, he writes about how the stories of his grandparents' experience more than 75 years ago resonate with him today.
When I was a little boy, my family had huge extended family gatherings. Part of almost every family event was a time during the day when my grandmother would sit down and tell her story. Each time, different family members would gather around, some who had heard the story before, others who hadn't, but all listening intently as Nana recounted the horrifying events that led her to America. Both of my grandparents and my grandmother's sister were survivors of the first Holocaust of the 20th century, the Armenian Genocide. Many Americans are not as familiar with the Armenian genocide as they are with the Holocaust suffered by the Jews. But ironically, Hitler himself referenced the Armenian genocide during a speech prior to the Holocaust to make a point about how such large-scale acts of aggression and murder can go unnoticed. Hitler was quoted as saying, "After all, who remembers the Armenians?" Indeed, future generations of Americans may not remember the Armenians either because of one simple fact. The United States government to this day has refused to officially recognize the genocide, choosing instead to protect a key political alliance with the country of Turkey. It is well known by historians, and there is overwhelming evidence of what took place between the years 1915 and 1923. During those years, the country of Turkey waged a systematic and deliberate campaign, which included the massacre and deportation of 1.5 million Armenians. My grandparents and my great-aunt were survivors of those atrocities, and their stories are echoed by millions of other survivors and their ancestors. On several occasions, my grandmother told her story of how, when she was a teenager, her family was forced from their home and marched through the Syrian desert. Her sister and herself, the only members of her family to survive the two-year-long ordeal. They got separated from their father and never saw him again. They walked 10 to 20 miles a day and at night made makeshift tents out of whatever they had. Along the way, she saw her brother murdered before her eyes and her mother die from the conditions they were forced to live under. Eventually, she and her sister were spared only because an Arabian family bought them for domestic help. Eventually, they would end up in an orphanage. At the orphanage was an older Armenian woman who had been able to smuggle large amounts of money with her along the march. This woman arranged marriages between girls in the orphanage and young men from the defeated Armenian army. She would then arrange paid passage for these families to America. My grandfather had been in the Armenian army and was sent away from his family to fight. When he arrived home, he found his village burned to the ground and his family had been killed. So the match was made. My grandmother, at 14, was married to my grandfather, who was 24. They were put on a ship with other refugees and sent to America in 1919. My grandparents and my great-aunt were not political people. They never spoke about the American government and whether or not it recognized the part of history that changed their lives. They felt nothing but gratitude to have the opportunity to live in such a country as this. One of my grandmother's favorite sayings was, "Life is pretty good in this country." Their cause was to educate the family. They wanted us to appreciate what they went through and how they overcame adversity. But like millions of other descendants of the survivors of the Armenian genocide, I still want one simple thing: for the country that I grew up in to recognize what my grandparents went through. To say, yes, this happened. It was an atrocity and it should be acknowledged so that it doesn't happen again. We need to remember the Armenians, because if we had, maybe we could have prevented the repeating of history in Germany, China, Bosnia, Rwanda, and so many others. Today, there was another march of Armenians, the annual march on Capitol Hill, and a commemoration of the Armenian genocide. Today marks the 87th anniversary of the Armenian genocide. 87 years and still waiting for a simple acknowledgement, still marching. Maybe someday the marching will end, and those that marched nearly a century ago will be remembered.
Darren Nanoogian lives in Dorchester, Massachusetts. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and